Thank you very much. So first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this conference. The talk that I'm going to give is based on these two papers with two of our postdocs, Anupam and Athira, and our student Chandramouli. So let me begin by giving a brief overview of what we want to do. Okay. So as you know, Bekenstein-Hawking formula for black hole entropy is universal. Okay. In any theory, it's given by this formula over here. And if we consider some specific theory like Einstein-Maxwell theory or say extended supergravity in d dimensions, then the black hole can in general carry a set of U1 charges, angular momentum in the Cartan-Sab algebra of the rotation group, and mass. And then we can express the area in terms of these fundamental parameters and express the entropy as a function of these charges. And in general, Q and J can have multiple components because we can have multiple U1 gauge fields, and in higher dimension, the Cartan-Sab algebra is multidimensional. Now, in two derivative theories of gravity, the entropy enjoys a scaling property, okay, and that takes this simple form that in D dimension, if you scale up the U1 charges by this factor, the mass by this factor, and the angular momentum by this factor, then the entropy also scales by this overall factor. And this suggests that we can take the macroscopic limit, okay, the large black hole limit, by simply scaling the mass, charge, and angular momentum in this fashion. And under this scaling, the entropy will scale as lambda to the d minus 2. And indeed, the reason behind this simple scaling property is that in this limit, the fields also have simple scaling. For example, the metric gets an overall factor of lambda square. You can choose the appropriate coordinate system in which lambda square comes out as an overall factor of the metric. Now, I should just add that in four dimensions, and it's only in four dimensions, that black hole can also carry magnetic charges, and that also scale as lambda. But magnetic charges are topological, and for most purpose, for most of my talk today, they'll just go as spectator. Okay, they'll not play too much of a role. Now, this formula, of course, is classical. The Bekenstein-Hawking formula is expected to receive quantum corrections and stringy corrections. And the general structure of the entropy, okay, starts with this leading term that I described earlier. But then there are power suppressed terms. And then there are terms that are proportional to log of the scale factor lambda. And the focus of attention in today's lecture will be terms that are proportional to log lambda. Because we'll see that these are somewhat semi-universal. They depend only on some infrared properties of the system, of the theory. And that this is something that you can actually compare with the microscopic results in some cases. So let me review the general procedure for computing corrections to the black hole entropy. Okay, and this follows the general procedure that was outlined by Gibbons and Hawking. Okay. And the idea is that we perform a path integral over all fields in the theory subject to the same boundary condition that the black hole satisfies. And this path integral generates a partition function containing log lambda corrections. Okay, typically, basically log lambda corrections come from one loop effects, and we'll see this in more detail later. The second step will be to construct the entropy from the partition function using the usual rules of statistical mechanics. In particular, if you are considering asymptotically flat black holes, then the gravitational path integral gives grand canonical partition function. And we need to take appropriate Laplace transform to get the microcanonical entropy. And this second step can also generate logarithmic corrections to the entropy. And you have to take into account both of these corrections. By following this procedure, one can compute the logarithmic correction to any black hole. Okay, and here I have given the simple example that if you take, for example, the curved black hole in pure gravity in d equal to 4, okay, we get a logarithmic correction of this form. And this means that any quantum theory of gravity that can count black hole microstates will have to reproduce this result. Because this result follows from infrared physics, okay, and it cannot be changed. Okay, so if you have a quantum theory of gravity, it better reproduce this from the counting. Unfortunately, at present, such accounting is not possible in string theory. But this can be remedied using supersymmetric black holes that I'll be now describing. Now, supersymmetric or extremal black holes have zero temperature, okay, and this causes some problem, okay, because instead of having a single large length scale like lambda, okay, we now have two large length scales and they are different. Okay. Mass and charge still scale as lambda to the d minus 3, okay, but the temperature that is defined as the derivative of the entropy with respect to the mass actually goes to infinity, sorry, this is the inverse temperature, goes to infinity for extremal or supersymmetric black holes. And this makes it somewhat difficult to extract log correction from the kind of analysis that I described earlier, because you have to deal with two scales, and whenever you encounter a log, you have to carefully examine whether it's log of beta or log of these, or some combination of log of beta and lambda that's coming in into the argument of the logarithm. Okay. Now, it turns out that there is a simple remedy for this, and that is to work in the near horizon geometry of the extremal black hole. So, extremal supersymmetric black holes have a near horizon geometry which has the structure of ADS2, okay, this is a two dimensional anti de Sitter space times some kind of squashed sphere, okay. If it's zero angular momentum, then it's a spherically symmetric solution, but in the presence of angular momentum, it can be squashed. And then the near horizon geometry of the black hole has a structure like this, where V1 and V2 are determined in terms of the charges and angular momentum of the system. But more importantly, both V1 and V2 scale as lambda square. So again, we see that the metric has an overall factor of lambda square, and we can compute logarithmic correction to the partition function by following the same guidelines. There are, however, two differences, okay, and these are important. The first difference is that the partition function now computes the path integral at fixed mass, charge, and angular momentum, because these modes dominate at r goes to infinity. Okay. So unlike in the case of flat space-time, where the partition function gave the grand canonical result, okay, expressed as a function of the chemical potentials and temperature, here the partition function directly gives the entropy as a function of mass, charge, and angular momentum. So no change of ensemble is needed. The second difference is that now we have to integrate over modes living in the near horizon geometry, okay, not in the full space-time geometry. Okay. And this means that we have a different set of eigenvalues and eigenfunctions than those in the full geometry. Okay. Nevertheless, one can follow this procedure and get some results. Okay. And here I have quoted some results that we get. Okay. So the final result in theories with n larger than or equal to 2 supersymmetry and d equal to 4. So for n equal to 2 supersymmetric theory, the logarithmic correction takes this form. Okay, you can see it's completely explicit. NH and NV are the number of vector and hypermultiplets. Okay. And that's all the logarithmic correction depends on. It doesn't depend on any further details of the theory. For n equal to 4 supersymmetric theories in 4 dimensions, okay, there is no logarithmic correction. There is an accidental cancellation. And for n equal to 8 supersymmetric theories in 4 dimensions, the logarithmic correction is, the coefficient is minus 8. And in n equal to 4 and n equal to 8 theories in 4 dimensions, one has exact microscopic counting of the corresponding microstates of the black hole. And these results that we see here are in perfect agreement with the microscopic counting formula. Okay. In fact, in n equal to 4, there is a whole class of models called the CHL type compactifications. And n equal to 8 theory, of course, is unique. That's the Storer's compactification of type 2. And the logarithmic corrections that you get by expanding the microscopic results agree with the logarithmic corrections that you get from the gravity analysis. And similar agreement also holds in d equal to 5, where we can again construct supersymmetric black holes and find the counting exactly. Okay, and the logarithmic corrections agree with the microscopic counting results. And finally, I should say that so far there is no microscopic counting for black holes in n equal to 2 theories. So this result here, okay, while macroscopic side gives a definite prediction, there is a microscopic result that can be matched with this. So with this brief review, I now turn to recent developments in the subject. So this started with this work by these three authors. And what they did was to describe a procedure for computing supersymmetric index using the full black hole geometry and not just the near horizon geometry. And our goal will be to use this formalism to compute logarithmic correction to the black hole entropy. So before we go to black holes, I'll spend a few slides reviewing what the supersymmetric index counts. So supersymmetric index that is relevant for this talk is given here. Okay, I'll explain the various notations. So J naught here is some particular Cartan generator in the rotation group, okay, which is what appears here. K is the momentum that a state carries. So right now we are not talking about black holes. Okay, this is some general states that you are considering. J prime represents Cartan generators other than J naught. Okay. And this notation, the trace with some subscript, okay, means that when you carry out the trace, you take trace over all states, but with fixed values of these charges. So you keep the electric charges fixed, the J prime fixed, the momentum fixed at zero, and then you sum over all other quantum numbers. Okay, that's what this trace represents. Okay. And the reason that this trace has been taken this way is because using properties of supersymmetry algebra, one can show that this trace gets contribution from only those states that break 2n or less J prime invariant supersymmetries. Okay. So first we understand, we look at what supersymmetries are invariant under the subalgebra generated by J prime. Okay. And then we can argue that the only states that contribute to this trace are those which break at most 2n of the J prime invariant supersymmetries. Okay. Now a generic non-BPS state will typically break all supersymmetries. Okay, and if n is sufficiently small, this number is larger than 2n. And hence they will not contribute to this index for sufficiently small n. Okay. So this means that this index gets contribution only from supersymmetric states or BPS states. And for those, the energy or the mass is fixed in terms of the charges. That's not an independent quantity anymore. So you expect this index to pick up the degeneracy of the supersymmetric states with fixed Q, J prime and K equal to 0. Okay, so that's the reason why the index is important, because it actually counts the degeneracy of supersymmetric ground states. Okay. So here I have stated this again, that this trace is expected to give the degeneracy of supersymmetric ground states, which I'm rewriting as e to the s BPS. And then there is this trivial factor minus beta times MBPS, because H, only H that contributes is the one for which mass is equal to the mass of the BPS state. And of course, momentum has been set equal to zero. So because it looks a little abstract, let me give some examples. Okay, so for example, in four dimensions, the rotation group is SU2. And the J naught we choose as the third generator of the this rotation group. So J prime is trivial, because SU2 has only one Cartan subalgebra, so there is no J prime. And the corresponding microscopic index is counted in the n equal to 4 and 8 supersymmetric theories with exact results. In d equal to 5, the rotation group is SU2 times SU2. Okay. And here I can take J0 to be the third component of the SU2R group. Okay. And then we are still left with SU2L. Okay. And I can take J prime to be the third component of the SU2L group. Okay. And now, from this formula, we see that J prime is J3L, so index will be a function of J3L and electric charges. Okay. And this number again is counted exactly in n equal to 2 and 4 supersymmetric compactifications, okay, which in fact will represent BMPP black holes when you go to the black hole description of the states. Okay. So this is the general property of the index. Okay. Now, let me describe how we can compute this index from gravitational path integral. So if you look at a black hole and take its Euclidean continuation, okay, then as is well known, it leads to a conical singularity at the horizon unless we first of all identify time periodically. Euclidean time tau has to be identified periodically. But in the presence of angular momentum, also azimuthal angle phi has to be twisted. Okay, so the periodic identification takes this form. And the time component of the gauge field also has to take a specific asymptotic value in order that the gauge field is non-singular at the horizon. So these quantities, beta, omega, mu that appear here, are in fact all fixed in terms of m, q and j for a classical black hole. And here are the specific formula that determine these quantities. And the interpretation of these quantities is that beta is the inverse temperature, omega is the angular velocity of the black hole, and mu is the chemical potential. And now using the scaling laws that I had described before, we can also figure out how beta, mu and omega scale, and they scale as follows. Note that here you are not talking about extremal black holes, so beta is not infinite, beta is of order lambda. Now when we go to quantum theory, instead of talking about classical black hole, if we talk about the gravitational path integral, there what you need to do is to treat beta, mu and omega as independent variables, and these are the ones which provide boundary condition to the path integral. So for example, the path integral is carried out over fields which satisfy this specific boundary condition, which have this periodicity, and the gauge fields are forced to have this value minus I mu at infinity. And the idea is that the gravitational path integral with these boundary conditions will give the grand canonical partition function which is given here. And here the trace is taken over all states of the system. Now what we will consider is not exactly the gravitational partition function, but gravitational partition function in full space-time geometry with insertion of a factor of 2 J0 to the n. And furthermore, I will choose omega 0 in such a way that beta omega 0 is 2 pi I. In that case, this partition function that we had earlier, I have now rewritten the omega dot g as a sum of two terms, and the beta omega 0 J0 term I have replaced it by minus 2 pi I J0. And now you see that this is nothing but minus 1 to the f if J0 is appropriately normalized. So this looks very much like the index that we had. So here, for comparison, I have written the expression for the index again, and we see that what goes inside is more or less the same as what we have here. However, there is some difference. The difference is that in the index I, we either take the trace for fixed q, k and j prime, as you can see, while in z, we sum and integrate over q, k and j prime, keeping mu and omega prime fixed. Here the trace is over all states. J0 and m are summed over both in the index and in the expression for the partition function. So this means that the z we can now regard as a sum or integral over q, k and j prime with I as the integrand, because it looks more or less the same except that in I these things are fixed, in z these things are all summed over. So using this we can express z as an integral over I, and I have now written as e to the s bps minus beta mbps, and this is the expression. So this is the relation between z and the degeneracy of bps ground states, and this is the formula that you have to use to extract s bps. Now let me just point out that here k is the momentum that is invariant under omega prime dot j prime. Why? Because you see that in the trace we had this factor of e to the minus beta omega prime dot j prime. So inside z, this trace a priori runs over all momentum. But if we consider a momentum that is not invariant under beta omega prime dot j prime, then acting on such a momentum eigenstate, it will change the momentum, it will give a different momentum, and hence in the trace it will not contribute. So the only momentum over which you have to integrate in computing this trace is the one that is invariant under beta omega prime dot j prime. And let's suppose that that momentum is nt dimensional, there are nt independent components over which you have to integrate, so that's this nt. Nc prime here is the number of independent j prime, that's the number of generators, which is the total dimension of the Cartan subalgebra minus 1, because j naught has been isolated. And nv is the number of u1 gauge fields, that's the dimension of q, so this is the integral we are doing. And the idea is that we will try to evaluate this integral using saddle point, and the contribution to the integral is clearly dominated by the Euclidean black hole saddle point. But what we are after is going beyond the classical result. We want to look for the Gaussian integral around the saddle point, and this will produce certain corrections that are proportional to log lambda. For example, if we look at the k integral over here, right, you have e to the minus beta k square over 2m, so it will give a factor of m over beta to the power nt by 2, and by using the scaling of m and beta, we can show that this ratio, okay, eventually generates a power of lambda of this guy. Similarly, q and j prime integrals will give you this determinant of the second derivative of s with respect to q, and that will be raised to the minus half, and again from the scaling of s and the scaling of q, we can figure out how many powers of lambda there will be, and similarly here, and we get a net factor of lambda coming from here. So putting these results together, we can relate s bps with log z. So this is the classical part, okay, the value at the saddle point, and then there is a correction, okay, that is due to the change of ensemble of the form c times log lambda, and the explicit form of c by using the formula that you saw earlier has this structure. Here let me remind you again is that nc prime is the number of generators j prime and nv is the number of u1 gauge fields that you have. Now in 4-dimension, this factor is trivially 0, okay, so you don't really see all these subtleties because d is equal to 4, so this is 0, okay, and nc prime is 0 in 4-dimension because the J0 spans the Cartan subalgebra, there is nothing outside J0. Okay. But in 5-dimension, this is a non-trivial factor and you have to take this into account. So this formula of course is not the final formula, okay, this is a final formula, but you have to still evaluate log z, right, because log z also receives corrections of order log lambda, okay, so you have to now evaluate log z from the gravitational path integral. And by simple power counting, one can argue that such contributions, the log corrections, come from one loop contribution of massless fields, okay, so that's a reasonably straightforward exercise. So let me briefly explain how this calculation is done. So let's suppose KB is a kinetic operator for massless bosonic fields in the black hole background. Okay, we take the black hole solution and expand all the action to quadratic order. Okay, so let's suppose that KB is the kinetic operator for massless bosonic fields and KF is the kinetic operator for the massless fermionic fields. Then one loop contribution to Z from the massless fields is given by this. Right, the standard determinant formula, and here I am not distinguishing between square root of determinant and the Pfaffian because we are only interested in the term lambda dependent terms, right, the phases are not of particular interest. So using this we can write the correction to log z as in terms of log determinant, and this we can write as in terms of trace of log of these operators. And in this formula, the lambda dependence comes from the simple fact that the eigenvalue, the KB, okay, as a differential operator has an overall factor of lambda to the minus 2. That has to do with the fact that the metric goes as lambda square. Okay. And KF, because it's a first order differential operator, has an overall factor of lambda inverse. Okay. And these traces now can be evaluated using the standard Hit kernel expansion, okay, which I'll not elaborate in detail, but there are this is well understood physics, okay, how to compute these traces in terms of the operators KB and KF. So the net result is that those traces can be evaluated and gives an expression for delta log z, okay, which is CL times log lambda, some coefficient CL, and this CL has the has the form as an integral of a local quantity. And this local object, okay, which is constructed out of the curvature and various other field strengths in the problem, okay, can be computed from the knowledge of KB and KF. Okay, there are standard formula to do this calculation. Now, one simplification that occurs for n equal to 2 and higher supergravity and d equal to 4, okay, and this in fact is a surprising simplification, is that Kx turns out to be proportional to the Gauss Bonnet term. This is not true in n equal to 1 supergravity or just normal gravity, okay, but when you have n equal to 2 or higher supersymmetry, it turns out that after you use equations of motion for the background, Kx can be written as an expression as proportional to the Gauss Bonnet term, okay, so CL becomes proportional to the Euler number. And furthermore, for odd D, okay, one can show in general from this heat kernel formula that CL is identically 0. Okay. However, we have to make some corrections. Okay. And the corrections to this formula come from the fact that there are also 0 mode contributions. So when we wrote this form and applied the heat kernel, we basically counted a factor of 1 over lambda square for every kb and 1 over lambda for every eigenvalue of kf without worrying about whether the eigenvalue is 0 or not. Okay, that's what the heat kernel gives you. But if it has 0 eigenvalues, okay, and typically the 0 eigenvalues arise from broken symmetries like translation, rotation, supersymmetry and so on. These cannot be treated as part of the determinant. Okay, so you have to make special effort to analyze the contribution from the 0 eigenvalues. Okay. So the first step is to correct for the error. We remove the contribution that we have included wrongly in the heat kernel formula. So you have to remove the contribution from log delta log z. So, for example, a bosonic mode contributes 1 over lambda square to the minus half, which is lambda to z, and that means it adds log lambda to log z. So, every 0 eigenvalue that you find, okay, this means that you have wrongly included an extra factor of log lambda in the expression for log z, so you have to subtract it out. So, you need to subtract log lambda from delta log z for each bosonic 0 mode, and similarly, you have to add log lambda by 2 to delta log z for each fermionic 0 mode. Right? This delta log z are the corrections to log z. Okay, so for example, I just gave an example of a counting of a number of rotational zero modes. So these must be generated by rotation outside the Cartan subalgebra of the group so that it deforms the solution. And this means that it must be invariant under it to be beta omega prime dot j prime. Oh, sorry, this is the first criteria. And the second criteria is that it must be invariant under this because it has to satisfy the periodicity along the Euclidean time circle. Right? If it doesn't commute with this, then it just gets twisted and it doesn't satisfy the required periodicity. So, the solutions of these to both of these is that in D equal to 4, we can take rotation about the 1 and 2 axis of SU2, right? Because in 4 dimension, J prime is trivial, right? And 1 and 2 axis of SU2 is outside the Cartan subalgebra. And in D equal to 5, we can take rotations about the 1 and 2 axis of SU2R. SU2L we cannot use because that doesn't commute with this. So, in both D equal to 4 and 5, the number of rotational zero modes is 2. And you can do similar analysis for counting transition and zero modes and broken supersymmetry zero modes. The second step is that you have to find the actual lambda dependent contribution to z from these zero mode integrals. And the way we do it is that we first note that zero modes arise from broken symmetries. So we express the integral over the zero modes as integral over the broken symmetry parameters and then carry out the integral. So this requires a change of variable. And for the fermionic zero modes, okay, we use the fact that the fermionic zero modes can be saturated by picking up the zero mode part of this. So from the gravitational perspective, the role that this 2J3 to the n plays is precisely to absorb the fermion zero modes. Otherwise, the result will be 0. And in this analysis, okay, there are several places where the log lambda comes in. The original integration measure may be lambda dependent. The Jacobian for the change of variables from the fields to symmetry transformation parameters can give lambda dependence. And finally, the integral over the symmetry transformation parameters themselves can also give log lambda. So you have to take into account all of these in order to get the total log lambda in the final answer. So here I have just given the net logarithmic correction from the zero modes, and that takes this form of Cz times log lambda, where Cz explicitly is given by this formula over here. Okay, Nt is a number that has appeared before. This is the number of transitions that commute with omega prime dot j prime, and nr is 2 in both in d equal to 4 and 5. And so now we have to add up all the contributions. Okay, c is a one that came from the change of ensemble, cl is just the integral of the of kx, and cz is this number over here coming from the zero modes. Okay. And after adding this, we find a general formula of this kind. And here let me remind you again that nr is always 2 in d equal to 4 and 5, nc prime is 0 in d equal to 4, 1 in d equal to 5, and CL is 0 in D equal to 5, but it's non-zero in D equal to 4. Okay, but its formula is explicitly known. Okay, I'm done. So at the end of all this, the final result is that the logarithmic correction to the index that you compute from the near horizon geometry and the full geometry give exactly the same result. Even though the intermediate steps are quite different. Okay, for example, even the ensemble is different, right? In the case of the near horizon geometry, we didn't have to change ensemble. So that C was not there. And this in turn also means that the index computed from the full geometry correctly reproduces the microscopic results when they are known, because the near horizon geometry is already known to produce the macroscopic results correctly. So with this now I come to the conclusion. So in a sense, the analysis that I described has only reproduced known results, but with a different method. However, still I believe that the agreement is significant due to several reasons. First of all, the computation using the full geometry uses integration over the same set of modes and same ensemble as that for non-supersymmetric black holes. This was not the case for the near horizon geometry analysis, because there you saw that the ensemble was different and the modes were different. Here you are using exactly the same set of modes. And the fact that this reproduces correctly the microscopic results gives us confidence in the results for non-supersymmetric black holes, for which there is no independent test of the formula. But at least we know that we are using exactly the same modes that we have used for non-supersymmetric black holes and same ensemble, we can reproduce correctly the supersymmetric black hole results. Now, in principle, the computation using full geometry is better because it can be used to take into account all configurations that contribute to the index, like multicentered black holes, which sometimes can contribute. And the analysis based on near horizon geometry can only be sensitive to one single centered black hole. And then you have to do extra work to put together the multicentered contribution. And finally, let me just say that there has been a lot of attempts to use localization on gravitational path integral to get exact microscopic exact formula for the black hole entropy from the macroscopic side. There are various issues with that formula. Some are ultraviolet, okay, which probably requires string theory to resolve. And some are infrared. And it seems that at least the infrared problems are easier to deal with when you use the full gravitational path integral with asymptotically flat space-time, because the asymptotic behavior of supersymmetric charges is somewhat better in flat space-time. So these are possible extra applications of this formalism. Okay. So with this, I'll stop. Thank you.
So thank you for the great talk. Maybe in the interest of time, we can just restrict to one or two questions. Go ahead.
Sorry. What are the arguments of your talk that don't work for the case of asymptotically ADS black holes?
What are the arguments? If it's asymptotically ADS black hole, then what happens is that the scaling that I described doesn't quite work the way I described, because you also have to scale the cosmological constant of ADS. Mm-hmm. Right. And this is something you don't want to do. You want to study the black hole properties in a fixed theory. Right? You want to keep the cosmological constant fixed. And that's why this kind of argument, right, doesn't directly go over to asymptotically ADS cases, unless we are looking for logarithmic term involving the cosmological constant of ADS.
Okay, so but also this has to do perhaps with the near horizon approximation. Perhaps it will.
Oh, in a near horizon approximation, it is okay, because there, if you scale up the charges, the cosmological constant scales, but that is just a parameter of the black hole, right? Because near horizon geometry, indeed, it is true that the cosmological constant of the near horizon geometry actually scales as you scale up the charges. But that we know is part of the black hole parameter. Right? It's not the, because ultimately that asymptote, the near horizon geometry is embedded in a flat space, right, where there is zero cosmological constant. And the cosmological constant that you see in the near horizon geometry is really coming because the black hole carries charges. So there it's okay. There you are allowed to scale the cosmological constant, because this is not a parameter of the theory. It's a parameter of the solution.
Thank you.
Any other urgent questions? Anything from online? Great. Okay, we'll do one quick online question.
Hello, am I audible?
Yes.
First of all, thank you for a great talk, sir. I have a little fundamental question to ask. Are there any observable consequences of these logarithmic corrections and how they affect the behavior of supersymmetric black holes in astrophysical settings?
I don't think there will be observational consequences for astrophysics because, I mean, even the classical entropy, I don't think these corrections are small enough so that I doubt that they will be of observational consequence for astrophysics. But certainly for theoretical studies, they are important because if we could, I mean, this puts a constraint on any kind of quantum gravity theory that you want to formulate. Right? Because it says that if somebody claims that they have a theory of quantum gravity and they can count the microstates of the black hole, they have to satisfy this, they have to reproduce these logarithmic corrections because these corrections are calculated purely from the infrared physics. Doesn't depend, is not sensitive to the ultraviolet physics, that computation. But nevertheless, if ultraviolet physics produces the counting, it has to reproduce these results. Right? So that's the significance of these logarithmic corrections.
Okay, sir. Basically, can you please tell, is there any possible astrophysical settings in ultra energy? Is there any energy range or something like that we in future will be able to detect it in astrophysical phenomena like ultra energy cosmic rays or very high energy physics, astroparticle physics sense?
Yeah, I don't see any immediate possibility of using this for astrophysical phenomena.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, well, thank you for the great talk. So let's all thank the speaker.